This message is a presentation of Pinnacle Baptist Church and the preaching ministry of Pastor Ray McBerry. Other messages like this are available online at pinnaclebaptist.com. The church is located at 2517 High Falls Road in Griffin, Georgia. If you're in the area, we would love for you to visit us this Sunday. Now, here's today's message.
The last week as we started chapter 6, it is, I guess, one of the most talked about, one of the most discussed, one of the most perhaps debated passages in all of the Bible, because it talks about the sons of God and the daughters of men. We talked last week about a couple of different possibilities of who these two groups of people were. Now, when it comes to the daughters of men, we said that there are really two possibilities, and the daughters of men could be simply referring to all of the daughters of men that were born from the time of Cain and Abel up until the flood. That would mean that it included all the women that were born to the lineage of Cain and all the women born in the lineage of Seth as well. So all the human women that were on the earth between Cain and Abel and the flood. The other possibility for the daughters of men is that it could be just specifically referring to the daughters of the line of Cain, the ungodly line of Cain. And the reason we say that's a possibility is because the other group that is mentioned in these verses are the sons of God. We won't reteach all that we talked about last week. We went into great depth talking about that last week. And we saw that there are a couple of schools of thought on who the sons of God are. There are some who believe that the sons of God are simply believers, men who are believers in the Old Testament. We know in the New Testament, believers are called the sons of God. In John chapter 1, it says, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. So in the New Testament, that term sons of God, it is referring to human men who are believers in Jesus Christ. But in the Old Testament, we looked at several other passages, and that term sons of God, when it's used elsewhere in the Old Testament, it is always referring to angels, not humans. And so the other possibility, instead of this being the descendants of Seth, who were still believers at the time, the other alternative is that these are angels, and in particularly because of what they do in Genesis 6, these would be fallen angels, bad angels, devils, or demons, as the world refers to them. And I told you that doesn't matter to me what you think, either one. There's actually some biblical evidence to support either side, and it's certainly not something worth splitting or parting fellowship over if somebody disagrees on it. I told you what your pastor's take on it is. I believe that there's really no way you can get around the fact that it is talking about angels because of the term that's used, sons of God. However, I do not believe, like a lot of people believe, who believe that those fallen angels literally procreated with human women to produce strange, crazy, hybrid offspring. I don't believe that. I don't believe that angels can reproduce, period. But I believe what angels do have the ability to do, those fallen angels have the ability to possess the bodies of lost men and women. And so I think what happened is that those fallen angels, they set about to mess up all of God's creation, starting with humans, starting with man, because man is the part of creation that is the heart of God. God made the rest of creation for his glory, but for our use, for mankind's use. So the way for Satan to best get at God is to get at mankind. He can't hurt our God, but he can hurt man, and that hurts the heart of God. So I believe what those fallen angels did is they possessed the bodies of lost men and women. And I'll even go a step further tonight and say, we ran out of time last Sunday night, didn't really have time to to say more, but I believe there's a good possibility that those lost men that were possessed by these fallen angels, possessed by these devils, in all likelihood, they may have made that choice voluntarily, may have made a deal with the devil or devils. And it is possible that those lost men, especially from the line of Cain, who allowed these fallen angels to possess them, to do their genetics experiments through them, through their bodies, may have made deals similar to things you've read about in literature before, where someone literally sells their soul to the devil in exchange for money or wealth or fame or power or whatever it might be. And I say that because, as we saw in the fourth verse of chapter 6 last week, it says there were giants in the earth in those days. And that word giants is a word that you will see and hear talked about a whole lot from this particular chapter. And the word is Nephilim. And the word Nephilim is translated giants in our Bible. The term literally means fallen ones. And I don't think that these are the fallen angels themselves. These are the offspring that were produced as a result of the unions between the daughters of men and the sons of God. But it says there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. Angels, I don't think, can produce children with humans or with themselves. The number of angels is fixed. They don't procreate in heaven. I don't think they can do that on earth either. But it says they the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Now, renown means they were famous. Mighty men means they were known for being mighty in one area or another. They might have been mighty in their strength or their size or their intellect. Could be in a number of different ways. I want to remind us that at the end of chapter 4 that we saw just a few weeks ago, when we saw the ungodly line of Cain and we saw the names listed in the lineage of Cain, you'll remember that there were several men mentioned by name in Cain's lineage that were famous. One of them was Tubal-Cain. He was an artificer of brass and metallurgy. He is the father of all that work with metals. Then we saw the other two boys in the lineage of Cain there. One was Jubal, the father of all as such as play the harp, musicians. By the way, we know who the first great musician was that God created. That was Satan himself when he was still Lucifer around the throne of heaven. He was the choir director of heaven. He certainly knows and understands the power of music. I don't think that it's any coincidence that one of the first people mentioned in the ungodly line of Cain is someone that is skilled in the use of music. And then Jubal's brother, Jabal, is called the father of all as such who live in tents and have flocks. So he was a nomadic herdsman, basically. But they are regarded as the father of those different areas of life, those different fields, if you would. And I would suppose there's a good possibility there were some other men that lived between the time of Cain and Abel and the flood that were probably the father of this or the father of that too. And I would not be surprised if Tubal-Cain and Jubal and Jabal and some of these other men were, in fact, some of those Nephilim, those men who were the mighty men of old, the men of renown. And I don't think it's beyond the possibility that those men, those lost men who made deals with those fallen angels to voluntarily, not involuntarily, but voluntarily give possession of their bodies to these fallen angels to do their experiments, whatever they wanted to do, in exchange for money, power, fame, wealth, great intellect, whatever it might have been. So I think that we ought to at least consider those as possibilities. I do not believe that angels actually procreated with human beings, but I think they used the bodies of unsaved men to do that. And as I said last week, I think they were attempting to genetically change the makeup of those humans they were using to create a master race that they controlled, Satan controlled, instead of God controlling. And of course, their overall goal was to thwart God's creation, change, usurp what God was doing. Brother Mike?
Science gone astray. They've become like Satan's Frankenstein's children.
That's a good illustration, a good analogy, Brother Mike. He's talking about the book Frankenstein and the story there. That's a good analogy.
Not too far afield to realize that happened today. Because people allow Satan bending to overtake them to do his will.
That's exactly right. People are still allowing themselves to be used by Satan and his minions today. Good point, Uncle Milton. Do you remember in Genesis chapter 3 when we saw the fall of man and the punishments, the judgments that God directed towards the man, the woman, and the serpent? Genesis 3:15 is the first mention of the gospel. That big theological term is proto-evangelium, first mention of the gospel. Do you remember what that verse said? It was when God was speaking to the serpent, and indirectly he was speaking to Satan himself and the judgment upon him. Yes, sir, Alex? You got it. That's the verse. Alex got it right. God told the serpent, and through the serpent he was telling Satan, that the seed of the serpent would bruise the heel of the seed of the woman, but the seed of the woman would bruise his head, that is, crush his head. And of course, there's only one person in all of the Bible that is the seed of a woman, not the seed of a man. And that is Jesus, who was born of a virgin. The Holy Spirit of God was his physical father. He had no human father, so Jesus is the only man ever born who was the seed of a woman. Satan knew from the beginning in the Garden of Eden what God's plan of redemption was, because God laid it out from the Garden of Eden on, that he was going to provide a redeemer for humankind, someone to pay the penalty for our sins. I can't help but believe that what these fallen angels were trying to do is that they were trying to corrupt even the genetics of the human race to create a situation where there would be no member of the human race that could be used by God to bring about the Messiah, the Redeemer. Now, I know Jesus' physical father was going to be the Holy Spirit of God. Satan certainly understood that too, because God called him the seed of the woman. But if he could corrupt all of humankind's genetics, DNA, totally change us into something different than the human race God created, perhaps all of that plays into what they were trying to do, these fallen angels, in corrupting mankind and corrupting the flesh of mankind. Preacher, why do you talk about the corrupting of the genetics and the corrupting of the flesh of mankind? I say that because the verses we're about to look at. We got down this past week through verse number 7, and so we're going to pick up with verse number 8. After saying all of that wickedness that was going on, verse 8 is one of the most beautiful verses in all the Bible. It says, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." Grace. Grace has been described by some as God's unmerited favor. That is God doing something good for us that we don't deserve. That's God's grace. He does that for us every day in reality, but the offer of salvation to us is the greatest measure of God's grace to us. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Does it say that Noah deserved God's grace? Noah deserved to be saved? No. But we could put our own names in there too. I didn't deserve God's salvation. I didn't deserve His free gift. You didn't deserve that. We could put our own names in there. Noah found grace in the sight of God just like you and I did. And it says, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Verse 9, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man. That is, he was righteous. He was justified by God and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. We know what it means when it says Noah walked with God. It means not only was he justified, he was a believer, but that he walked with God, that's the same thing it said about Enoch, wasn't it? That he walked with God and he was not, for God took him. So it's telling us that Noah was not just a saved person, if we could use that term, but he was a saved person that took his relationship with God seriously, and he walked with God, just like you and I are commanded to do too. The other part of that verse, though, it says that he was perfect in his generations. Now, several weeks ago, I gave out a timeline that showed the genealogy of Noah and how long each of those men before him and after him lived. And there are some who believe that what it is saying here in verse number 9 is that all those in Noah's family that we have recorded before him, when it says he was perfect in his generations, there are some who believe that means that all those in his family were just men also. They were believers also and had passed down the message of salvation to their children. And that's how Noah ended up becoming a believer himself. I think that's very likely. I think that's probably the primary interpretation here. I will say, though, that when it says he was perfect in his generations, there is also some room to believe that if, in fact, those fallen angels were attempting to corrupt the DNA of mankind through whatever they were doing, it's very possible also that, you know, what it's telling us here is that Noah was still just the way God made mankind in the first place, and that his family had not been, their flesh had not been corrupted with the mating of these people that were possessed by fallen angels that were doing their whatever kind of genetic experiments they may have been doing. That's right, exactly. They were not listening to the wrong music and following the wrong crowd. Verse 10, and Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now these three boys are going to be important. We'll see them in chapter 10 after the flood is over with, because they become the fathers of all the nations of the earth that are here after the flood. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So you want to remember their names if you don't have it down already. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And when it says the earth was corrupt before God, that doesn't mean that the dirt was corrupt before God. What is it telling us? The people were, exactly, Brother John. The people of the earth were corrupt before God. All the people of the earth, almost entirely. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me. For the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So God says, all of flesh on the earth has become corrupt. And I'm going to destroy them, Noah. Again, Certainly, this is because of the sinfulness of their hearts. The Bible said their even the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually. It's hard to think of something much worse than that. It could also mean, too, that they were these fallen angels doing whatever they were doing through the lost people that were freely giving themselves to be possessed by devils. They were allowing this corruption to go on. Brother Mike?
Yesterday I was at Sam's in McDonald's. This car pulled in front of me, and on the back were witchcraft and all these symbols, and witches, and that's a person who would allow Satan free reign in their life.
You're exactly right.
Whatever the magic that they,
You're exactly right. And so, you know, at this time before the flood, certainly those from the ungodly line of Cain, but apparently almost everyone also from the line of Seth had become corrupted also. Not only in their flesh, but in their hearts. And they were not serving God. They had fallen away from God. Verse 14 says, God giving directions to Noah what to do before the flood comes when he destroys the earth. He said, make thee an ark of gopher wood. Bible scholars still debate today what actual gopher wood is. There are some scientists who believe they know what kind of wood this was, but apparently it's a very hard wood, whatever it is. Those that were here a couple of Wednesday nights ago, I showed a video that Wednesday night that I also showed a couple of years ago. I think Brother John was here when I showed it a couple of years ago. On the site they believe is the discovered Noah's Ark up on Mount Ararat. And they've actually even examined some of the pieces of petrified wood from there. And apparently whatever boat is stuck up in the mountains there in eastern Turkey, if it be Noah's Ark, those samples must be petrified samples of whatever gopher wood is. But it must have been a hard wood. It must have been a wood that was durable. But it says, make an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark. So it wasn't just a big open boat. It had rooms inside it. And shalt pitch it within and without with pitch. That is something to make it watertight, waterproof. In the video that we watched a couple of Wednesday nights ago on Noah's Ark, the wood that they have found, that's it's fossilized, it's petrified at this point, but they were able to determine that the wood was actually I'm trying to think of the correct term. The type of lumber that we use now, where it's thin strip, it's thin pieces of wood, and they are glued together, laminated. Yeah, and that's what they discovered. The wood that's still there at these remains of Noah's Ark are up there in Mount Ararat. They were undoubtedly using technology that we use today to make wood that would be lightweight but flexible to make the shape of a boat. And so they used pitch within and without to make it watertight as well. And this is the fashion which thou shalt make of it. Now God's going to give him the dimensions. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. All right, now I want to stop right here, and I want to do a little bit of math. TR, do you have a calculator on your phone? All right, would you get your calculator out? We're going to do some math here, and we're going to let you do that with the calculator so we don't have to go back to school. Some what? Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's see. Let me use this one. It erases easier. All right, so what did it say that the length of the boat would be? 300 cubits. And the breadth of it? 50. And the height of it? 30. Right? So the length, the width, and the height. It's a three-dimensional object, right? All right, so historically, a cubit is generally considered to be from the tip of the longest finger to the elbow, and it has generally been assumed and calculated throughout history all the way back to ancient times. That's roughly how many inches in a cubit? Anybody know? 18 inches. 18 inches. So TR, here's what we want you to do with your calculator. We want you to multiply 300 times 18 inches.
5,400.
All right, now divide that by 12, and that should tell us how many feet this is.
450
feet. All right, now hold that thought. All right, now let's do the same with the width, TR. Multiply 50 times 18.
75 feet.
Okay, now divide that by 12.
That's what I
did. Oh, you did that. All right, so that's 75 feet. You were getting ahead of me. Bad student. He jumped the gun. All right, TR, do the same for the height now. 30 cubits times 18 inches divided by 12.
45.
They already had you beat, TR. They were faster than you were with the calculator. Now, 450 feet long by 75 feet wide by 45 feet tall. How long is a football field? 300 feet from goal line to goal line, and then if you add the 20, the 10 yards on either side, that's another 20. It's bigger than a football field. This is a big boat that we're talking about. It's wider than a football field, and it's 45 feet tall. That's about four stories tall as far as our buildings today would be calculated. But here's the thing. That video that we watched of that big boat that was found in the mountains of Ararat in eastern Turkey, lo and behold, they figured they must have found something besides Noah's Ark. Because in fact, the boat that they have found up there in the mountain is not 450 feet long. Instead, it's right at 500 feet long. And so some of the Bible archaeologists were telling Ron Wyatt and some of the others, this cannot be Noah's Ark. It doesn't fit. It's not the right dimensions. And then they said, wait a minute. Who is the human author that God used to write the book of Genesis?
Moses.
Moses. And Moses was educated in Egypt. So they said, let's go back and recalculate this using Egyptian measurement for a cubit. TR, you got your calculator still out? He's already put it up. All right, you got to get it back out. So TR, let's do it this way. Multiply 300. You ready? 300 times 20 instead of 18. And then divide that by 12. Comes out to exactly 500 feet. Exactly what the dimension of that big boat is that's up there in the mountains. Now, what would be the odds of a boat stuck way up in the mountains where there's no water that's exactly the dimensions of Noah's Ark in exactly the place that Noah's Ark was supposed to have come to rest and it not be Noah's Ark? By the way, there's some other very interesting things they talk about in the video, such as carvings and all on some of the rocks around that, some of the boulders where someone in ancient times depicted eight people on a big boat right there where the ark is sitting. So anyway, lots of interesting things. I'll send you the link to it if you've never seen that. Let me know. I'll be happy to text you the link. You can watch it. But those are the dimensions. 300 cubits by 50 cubits by 30 cubits. A window shalt thou make to the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above. In other words, there was to be one window in the ark, and it was to be almost right at the top of the ark, just about a foot and a half before the top of the boat. In other words, the window was supposed to be up at the top. You wouldn't want to put the only window down at sea level. That might not be the best idea. They put it at the top of the boat. And the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof. We've all seen pictures of Noah's ark with a door in the side. And then the Lord said, with lower, second, and third stories shalt thou make it. So it was a three-story boat. This is one big boat. And I know TR and I love to go to Charleston, South Carolina, and in the harbor there, they have the USS Yorktown, and you can go take tours of it and spend all day on it if you want to. Brother Bob, there's a lot of walking for you if you really want to do a lot of walking. But this is like almost a big aircraft carrier, three stories tall. God said, and behold, I, even I, do bring a flood of waters upon the earth, to destroy all flesh wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. God said, I'm just going to wipe the slate clean and start over. Verse 18, but, here's the important but with thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee. Now, first of all, he said, I'll establish my covenant. What is a covenant? What's another word for a covenant? An agreement, a contract, a promise. That's right. That's what a covenant is. All of those things. Good. And so God said, I'm going to make a covenant with you. This is an agreement, contract, a promise. We're both making promises here, but God said, I'm going to make you a promise. And the promise, he said, is that he was going to save him and his family from this worldwide flood. So how many people were saved alive on the ark? Eight, that's right. There was Noah, Mrs. Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Mrs. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So eight souls were saved alive on the ark. And I know Hollywood and writers over the years have tried to add other people that somehow were stowaways on the ark, and they managed to survive the flood too. Some of those legends even say some of the giants from before the flood somehow managed to hang on to the ark or stow away on the ark, and that's why there are giants after the flood too. I don't think that's the case. The Bible says clearly there were eight souls that were saved on the ark. Everybody else perished in the flood. Yeah, it'd be hard to hang on to for 40 days and 40 nights, T.R. said. That's right. Look at verse 19. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark. To keep them alive with thee, they shall be male and female. So God said, He said, Noah, you're to bring into the ark two of all living creatures. Now, of course, we're talking about land creatures. No reason for the sea creatures to be in tanks on board the ark. They're just going to stay in the water. But God told him that he was to bring in two of every sort into the ark. So does that mean that Noah then was supposed to go out and round up two of every kind of animal? Was he supposed to just, he and his three boys, go out on safari expeditions and round up these different specimens?
No.
Let's read the next verse and see how that all came about. Of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. Notice what it said. Two of every sort shall what?
Come unto thee.
God sent the animals that were to be put on the ark. They didn't have to go find them. They didn't have to go round them up. They didn't have to say, well, let's go down the checklist. Okay, we got everything, it looks like, except the porcupine. Where's the porcupine? We don't have a porcupine. Somebody go find a porcupine. No, they didn't have to do that. God brought the animals to them, and they put them on the ark. They brought them into the ark as God brought the animals to them. Notice that it said in verse 20, it said, after their kind. Now, the word kind is not really a scientific term, the way scientists today categorize creatures with families and genus and species and all that. But the word kind is very closely related to the scientific term species. Not exactly the same, but it's similar. So what this is telling us is that God did not bring to Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth two German shepherds, two dachshunds. Brother John, what's yours? Two Jack Russells, two Labrador retrievers, two St. Bernards. No, he didn't do all of that. God brought to Noah and his sons two dogs. That's it, two dogs. He also didn't bring to Noah two African elephants. They're big, by the way. Two Indian elephants, two woolly mammoths. They're all elephants. God just brought him two elephants. And by the way, with all of these creatures that God brought to him, you reckon he brought the full-grown mamas and daddies to the ark?
Young ones,
because number one, they don't eat as much. Number two, they don't take up as much room. And number three, when they come off the ark, they got a lot more years to have babies and fill the earth back up. So these are the young ones of all the different kinds of animals. Yes, sir?
Somewhere in, I don't remember where that one where the two of a kind was a better kind, but the ones that were approved, you know, unclothed and all that were seven.
You got that right, and we're coming to that, but you're doing a TR and you're getting ahead of the story here, but you're right. So God said, I'm going to bring them to you. You put them on the ark, but these would have been the kinds, two of every kind. He was not going to, you know, we sometimes think, well, scientists today say there's something like 8.3 million species of land animals today, or something ridiculous like that. And they say that, and then some pointy-headed professor in university challenges a Christian student at their in their freshman year of college and says, you really believe Noah's Ark had two of every kind on the ark? And there are 8 million species? You really think they had two of every kind of 8 million species on there? Well, no, they didn't. They had two dogs, two elephants, two of every other thing. There are lots of different kinds of cattle in the world, but there were only two. There was a bull and a cow. And from them, all the other different strains of cattle that we have today emanated after the flood. There was more than enough room on this big boat that was three stories tall for them to put two of each kind of land creatures on the ark. By the way, most land creatures aren't big like elephants and hippopotamuses. Is that the correct plural? Hippopotamuses? Hippopotami? I don't know. Most land mammals and land creatures are not great big creatures like that. Most of them are small ones. And, you know, dinosaurs. I think that the Bible speaks about a couple of different kinds of dinosaurs in the Bible. But even if there were dinosaurs still living at the time, the dinosaurs, they would have been brought onto the ark too if they were land dinosaurs. But God wouldn't have sent two grown... The big Tyrannosaurus Rex or whatever, Brontosauruses, whatever they were. He wouldn't have sent two full-grown mama and daddies of those either. He would have sent two little bitty ones. You know, the thing about lizards and all reptiles is they start out little bitty and they grow their entire lives. They never stop getting bigger as a reptile. The longer they live, the bigger they get. That's the same way it is with iguanas, too, by the way. So if there were still dinosaurs living at that time, and I believe there were, then God simply brought to Noah and his sons some little baby ones. And they took them on board the ark. And then after the flood was over, they came off the ark. They started having a bunch of more little reptiles, and they grew up to be big reptiles. So there was more than enough room on this three-story boat for all the different kinds of land animals and creatures to be brought. Verse 21, God said, "And take thou unto thee of all food that is eaten, and thou shalt gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them." You know, there's another interesting thing that I remember Ken Hovind saying in one of his creation videos. He said, you know, it's an amazing thing that if you put an animal, any kind of animal, in a dark place with no lights on for 40 days, they go into, most animals are going to go into some form of hibernation. Now, your cat might not hibernate for 40 days and 40 nights like a bear would, but they're going to be less active, less moving around than they normally are during the day when the sun's out and they're out running around in the loose, in the wild. If they're in little stalls or cages or pens and there's no light in there except whatever candles Noah and his sons had, lanterns, lamps, then it's going to be dark in there. There's the sound of the rain coming down. They're going to eat less. So it would have required much less food than these animals normally would have needed for as long as they end up staying on the boat, even after the 40 days of the rain is over with. Yes, sir?
What happens when you rock a baby very long?
Ah, that's good. What happens when you rock a baby?
The boat is rocking and it's dark.
It's putting them to sleep, isn't it? So, you know, so in spite of the fact there was plenty of room to take food for all of them and the animals onto this big boat, the animals were all going to eat much less food while they were on the ark than they normally would eat as well. Thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. You ever wonder what would have happened if God had told Noah to do all this, gave him the exact blueprint, told him exactly how to build it, what to build, and Noah didn't build it? Well, I guess God would have just had to start all over.
It
wouldn't be talked about, that's right. God made provision for Noah and his family, but they still had to build the ark and go in the ark. God didn't make him build the ark. God didn't make them go into the ark. He gave them the free choice whether to do it, but God made provision for them if they wanted to be saved. Isn't that the way it is in the world today? God has offered a plan of salvation to the world today, and men can either accept it or reject it. Isn't it a sad thing that so many know and hear the plan of God's salvation, but they reject it? They turn away. They don't go inside the ark. They could go inside the ark, but they don't go inside the ark. What a tragedy, tragedy, tragedy that is. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. I remember the day that I found grace in the eyes of the Lord. You remember the day you found grace in the eyes of the Lord? If you're saved, I bet you do. And you've got a wonderful story, just like I do, just like Noah did. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Got to be one of the most beautiful verses in the Bible, I think. All right, that brings us to a close of chapter number 6. Any questions or comments for chapter 6?